Bonsoir. Bonsoir tout le monde. Mon nom est Véronique Bélanger. Je suis doyenne adjointe planification stratégique à la faculté ici, avec mon collègue Frédéric Bachan qui est avec nous ce soir. Je co-organise cette série de conférences de formation continue qu'on appelle Think Ahead, une pensée d'avance. C'est un grand plaisir de vous accueillir à la faculté de droit de McGill ce soir pour la conférence inaugurale de la saison 2014-2015. Our focus this year will not be on a specific field or branch of the law as it was last year, but rather on law's relevance to key themes that are at the heart of some of the most important policy debates of our times: the impact of new technologies and novel science on social relations, commerce, and education, the rise of law and order agendas and the so-called victims' rights movement here in North America and elsewhere in the world, the proper role of ethics in commercial relations, and the extent to which Canada's Living Three Constitution keeps up with a rapidly evolving political and socio-economic landscape. Tonight, for the first lecture, we focus on tax and fiscal policy, which lie at the heart of many contemporary debates, touching on issues such as public pension reform, the offshoring of corporate profits, or the effectiveness of sector-specific tax credits. Our panel of experts will provide multifaceted insights on key public policy challenges currently facing our governments. Allow me first to introduce our speakers. Alison Christians holds the H. Heward Steichman Chair in the Law of Taxation at the McGill University Faculty of Law. Her research and teaching focus on national and international tax law and policy issues, with emphasis on the relationship between taxation and economic development, and on the role of governments and non-government institutions and actors in the creation of tax policy norms. Before entering academia, she practiced tax law in New York. She taught at the University of Wisconsin Law School and Northwestern University School of Law, before joining the Faculty of Law in 2012. Professor Christians has written extensively on national and international tax law and policy issues. She is also very active online, where she regularly comments on developments in international tax law and policy on her Tax, Society, and Culture blog, and on Twitter, if some of you wish to follow her, at TaxPaulBlog. In May 2014, she was awarded the John Durfer Prize in Teaching Excellence by the Law Student Association of McGill University. Tonight, Professor Christians, who will actually speak second, will give a talk entitled When Local is Foreign, in which she will discuss the implications of the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, otherwise known as FATCA, in Canada. Notre deuxième conférencier, Daniel Weinstock, est diplômé de littérature française et de philosophie de McGill et Oxford, où il a été l'étudiant de Charles Taylor. Il a d'abord été professeur titulaire au département de philosophie de l'Université de Montréal. Depuis 2012, il s'est joint à la faculté de droit de McGill et il est titulaire d'une chaire James McGill. Il est également directeur depuis 2013 de l'Institut de recherche sur les politiques sociales et de santé de McGill. Considéré comme l'un des plus importants philosophes canadiens, Daniel Weinstock s'intéresse à l'éthique et à la philosophie politique, notamment à l'impact de la diversité culturelle sur l'éthique des politiques publiques. Son expertise quant à la diversité des valeurs présentes dans les sociétés modernes est très régulièrement sollicitée, aussi bien par les médias que par différentes institutions. Il a participé activement à de nombreux débats sur les politiques publiques au Québec et au Canada, notamment sur l'enseignement de la religion dans les écoles publiques, sur les accommodements raisonnables et sur les soins de fin de vie. Tonight, Daniel Weinstock will be talking about why philosophy needs law and why law needs philosophy in thinking about fiscal policy. Professor Scott has generously accepted to join Professor Weinstock and Professor Christians at the podium tonight. And many of you, of course, know him well. I'm willing to guess that many of you might have actually been a student of his. Professor Scott is a graduate of arts in law, of arts and law of McGill, and holds a DPhil degree from Oxford. He taught at McGill from 1967 to 2002 and was appointed Professor Emeritus of Law in 2003. Throughout his career, he has taught and conducted research in public and commercial law with a focus on constitutional law and the law of banking and negotiable instruments. For over three decades, he has actively participated in debates on public issues in Canada, particularly on constitutional questions. He has appeared before the Supreme Court of Canada on numerous occasions. In fact, he told me earlier today that his first case in the Supreme Court of Canada was a constitutional tax case. Professor Scott has generally accepted to act as a répondant tonight. He will comment briefly on both presentations and moderate the discussion and question periods. Please join me in welcoming them. Before we begin with the formal part of our program, let me make a few housekeeping announcements. If you haven't done so already, please shut off anything that rings or buzzes. There will be one break this evening about midway through, around 7:30. During the break, if you need to, there are washrooms situated in the basement. And you will find in the atrium a table and some snacks from the table manned by students. Tonight, the proceeds will go to support the McGill Model UN Student Group. It is a group that allows students to participate in simulations of the UN work around the world. These simulations provide students with a great experience in international relations and international law. This year, the delegation from the faculty will be representing Panama at Harvard in February. You will receive an email shortly after this evening's lecture with your attestation certificate. If you have not yet done so, please make sure that you check in at the table in the atrium during the break so that we know you are here and we can send you the attestation. Alors, avant de commencer et de passer la parole à M. Scott, je voudrais inviter très brièvement ma collègue Natalka Arras, qui est directrice associée au développement à la faculté, à vous adresser la parole.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm Nat Harris, the Director of Development here, and I'm here to ask you to consider giving to the faculty this year, philanthropically, to the Faculty Development Fund. This year, for the first time, we're giving people the option to give to four different themes in the faculty. And I'm going to show you a very easy way to give. If you go to our website, if you click on Alumni and Friends, and then go to Support the Faculty, this year, for the first time, you can choose whether you wish to support the four priority themes of the faculty, which is maintaining our global academic presence, expanding our innovative pedagogy, which I'm sure all of you benefited from, supporting our cutting-edge legal research, and community engagement. So there's something here for everyone, and we really do invite you to make a contribution. If you go to the website, you can simply click on any one of these and give and choose, you know, the theme that you'd like to give. So this is a great help to the faculty. It's a great help to the dean. It's a source of flexible funding for the faculty for all the wonderful initiatives that we do here. And I'd really appreciate it if you considered giving a gift. The other thing that I wanted to point out was that, unfortunately, this year the faculty has lost some truly towering spirits. And there are funds set up in the memory of Professor McDonald, Professor Tetley, and Professor Glenn. So if you'd like to make a contribution to any of those funds, we do invite you to do so. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening. If you have any questions, you can also find my contact information on the faculty website, and I wish you a wonderful continuing legal education session. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dean Bélanger and Narelka. It occurred to me when I was asked to share this that many might be depressed at the thought of paying 49.97% in combined marginal tax rate, income tax as a Quebec resident, and that some comfort could be found in the thoughts of Benjamin Franklin, taxation. He said, friends and neighbors, the taxes are indeed very heavy. And if those laid on by the government were the only ones we had to pay, we might more easily discharge them. But we have many others, and much more grievous to some of us. We are taxed twice as much by our idleness, three times as much by our pride, and four times as much by our folly, and from these taxes the commissioners cannot ease or deliver us by allowing an abatement. It also occurred to me that many of us arrive at these sessions a bit worn out from our work day and feel perhaps that we should be allowed to depreciate our bodies, claim an income tax deduction for the for wear and tear of your bodies. Now, I have to say that this has already been tried, and you could find this in Norman and Golder, Inspector of Taxes, in the English Court of Appeal, 1945-1, All ER 352. I have to say that it did not succeed on that occasion, but perhaps it might on another. So, without further ado, I hand it over to my colleague, Professor Weinstein.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very great pleasure to be here this evening. As you may have guessed, I'm the warm-up act. Those of you who attend concerts, you know that there's the person that you have to get through patiently while the real entertainment arrives, and that's Allison. So think of me as the warm-up act. So I'm guessing that other than our natural charm and intellect, the reason that Allison and I have been asked to lead this discussion is that since September, she and I have been involved in, I think, quite a novel, innovative, pedagogical initiative, which is to co-teach a class in the foundations of tax policy. I'd like to tell you a little bit about how this began. So as Véronique told you, I was trained originally as a philosopher. I am, as we say in French, un transfuge, who moved into a law faculty late in life. Shortly after I arrived here, I've only been here for about 3 years, Allison called me up at my office and said, Daniel, I want to take you out to lunch and convince you that the most important thing that you could be doing in your time here at McGill is to teach a course in tax law with me. At first I thought she was joking. Allison, I've been told, has a very great sense of humor, which I'm sure will be on full display when she lectures after I do, but she was actually dead serious. Since there was the offer of lunch, as it were, on the table, I decided to see whether this was in fact the case, and we had a tremendous lunch downtown where she in fact convinced me that, as it were, we needed one another. Thus, the title that I proposed for my intervention, which is why law needs philosophy and why philosophy needs law in thinking about tax policy. She convinced me that there were all kinds of fascinating philosophical questions that lay just below the surface of some of the most important questions of tax policy, but that these questions had been unanswered by tax lawyers themselves who tend to, I don't know, I'm just taking her word about this, who tend to just sort of stay at the technical and administrative level of tax policy, and that really a lot of these questions needed to be thought about afresh. So enthused was I with her offer that not only did I say yes, but I forgot that she had actually invited me to lunch, and she didn't actually pick up the check, as far as I can remember. So we have, for the last few months, we began this course in September with about 15 willing guinea pigs, but have been talking about it for quite a while before that. And what I want to do in the time that I have for my talk is just to substantiate from the point of view of a philosopher, from the point of view of someone who has looked at these issues from the point of view of political philosophy, why it is that she's absolutely, why law needs philosophy, she will tell you in her talk, but why philosophy needs law is something that I hope to convince you of in the few minutes that I have to talk to you. So raise your hands, those of you who have some philosophy in your background. Okay. Raise your hands amongst, I would assume that's actually not a lot of people. Who raised their hands there. Does the name John Rawls ring any bells with you? Raise your hand if who said yes. Right. So that's also not a lot of people. So I'm gonna talk to you a little bit about the way that philosophy and the way that philosophy at its very highest reaches has dealt with the problem of what it thinks of being the problem of taxation. And what I want to do is to hand off to Allison by showing you that the really interesting questions, the really interesting philosophical and ethical questions that lie at the basis of tax law and tax policy have really not been the surface of them has not even been scratched by even the best of the philosophers amongst us, and why it is that our project really is one that I think is both novel and important. So I'm going to give you a few minutes of philosophy. I promise it won't hurt. This is one of the reasons why we decided that I would go first. You haven't been completely exhausted yet by your day. If this had been at the very end, it would have been perhaps too much to ask of you. So political philosophers, I think, take themselves to have been dealing with issues that are relevant to tax law for many, many years. And they have done so by talking about an issue which in the philosophical literature is referred to as distributive justice. Distributive justice. So as the term indicates, the idea of distributive justice is, well, how do we distribute the resources that social life makes possible, right? What Rawls calls the cooperative surplus. How do we distribute it in a manner that is just and equitable? Now, there are tremendous philosophical disquisitions that have been devoted to this question, and I could have picked a number of them. I could have picked the writings of a late friend of both Stephen and mine by the name of Jerry Cohen, who occupied a very important chair in political philosophy at Oxford University. But I'll tell you the story of the way that John Rawls thought about this, because his book, which is called, in a way which when you think about it is magnificently sort of arrogant, A Theory of Justice, right? This book called A Theory of Justice in 1971, which is a canonical book that's been translated into just about all the languages in which philosophy is taught. It is one of the most widely read books of philosophy, one of the most widely commented upon books on philosophy. We could probably fill this room twice over with books and articles that have been devoted to this 600-page tome, which pretends, ambitiously to describe a complete theory of justice for a modern society, starting with what Rawls thinks is a fairly unambitious starting point, a starting point that is fairly intuitive, one that can be shared by just about any citizen of a modern society, regardless of whether he or she has done any philosophy or not. And the idea that Rawls calls his theory the theory of justice as fairness, the theory of justice as fairness. The guiding intuition between justice as fairness is the idea that in order to think about justice, what are the principles of justice that should be at the core of a modern society that pretends to be just? Well, the starting point should be one that is fair. What does fairness mean? Well, here's an anecdote. When the theory of justice was translated into French, the French translator was having trouble with the word fairness. How should I translate fairness, she asked Rawls. Rawls speaks a little bit of French. He read a lot of French philosophy. And he says, what is the word that kids use when they're in a sandbox and one of them grabs, the bigger one usually, the bigger, stronger bully, grabs a pail away from the other one, and the other one spontaneously, without even thinking about it, says, hey, that's not fair. And the translator, who's a woman who I know very well, said, it's not going to help us very much here, because what a French kid would say is, c'est pas juste, right? So a theory that would be called justice comme justice would not be particularly evocative. But the basic idea of there being something in that scenario that speaks to our intuitive core idea of fairness, I think, is one that is quite powerful. The idea is that just because you're stronger, just because you're bigger, just because you're able to, doesn't mean that you get to keep everything that your strength and your greater ability allows you to get by dint of your sheer force. A society that's fair is one that doesn't make what people get a pure function of how strong they are, how rich they are. Now, to get a little bit more technical, of what their starting points in life are. So Rawls notices something that You know, it's again completely obvious and not at all a philosophical discovery of any great magnitude. We all start off our lives at very different points along at least two different kinds of, if you will, hierarchies or ladders. Some of us are born in very fortunate socioeconomic circumstances. Some of us are born in rather less fortunate socioeconomic circumstances. First hierarchy. Some of us are born with talents that just happen to be compensated very well in the particular economy that one is a part of. If I had been born at some other period in time, maybe the ability that comes with being a philosopher would be rewarded as well as the ability of being a hockey player does in our society. Unfortunately, I don't live in such a period or in such a society, if one is even imaginable. Imagine that I was. It would be no credit to me that there just happened to be this link-up, this matching between what I'm good at and what society rewards. If you're born 6'11" and you're able to, you have some degree of hand-eye coordination and you can shove sort of spherical objects into nets with some degree of regularity, perhaps some of that is down to your effort and persistence, but to some degree it's just a matter of dumb genetic luck. Or that you were born tall and that you're able to play a sport that rewards people who can play it rather handsomely. So here are these two ladders that we are born on very different points, you know, along these ladders. Some of us are born in very fortunate circumstances. Some of us are born rather well endowed in talents which are marketable in the particular market economy that we are a part of. And we're born that way. We haven't done anything yet. And our genes and our family circumstances already place us either very favorably or very disfavorably with respect to the kinds of advantages that we can expect. Now, Rawls says a just society, just like justice in the sandbox means that the big bullyish kid doesn't get to just use his strength to take the bucket away from his slightly weaker friend, a just society is one that's going to want to neutralize, to some degree at least, the impacts of luck, on where we situate ourselves on these two ladders. Right? And so he proposes the following thought experiment. Thought experiments are always good, a good way to philosophers do thought experiments because we don't get much research funding in philosophy departments, so we have to do thought experiments because we can't afford Bunsen burners and test tubes and things like that. Do people still use Bunsen burners?
Yes, they do.
So we have thought experiments. And so this is a very thought experiment which basically says the following thing. Imagine that we were to think about what the principles of justice for our society should be, but we do it from a perspective in which we don't know what our individual positions along these two hierarchies will be. We're placed behind, to use Rawls's wonderfully evocative expression, a veil of ignorance. A veil of ignorance. We are temporarily rid of all information that we have about where we are situated along these two hierarchies, along these two continuums. And then we're told, in this position of radical uncertainty, in which you have to think about ways in which to distribute the most important goods that social institutions distribute. And in Rawls's view, they are three. Basically, what the institutions of a modern society does is they distribute three kinds of things. They distribute rights, right? They distribute rights, they distribute opportunities, and they distribute material resources. So rights, opportunities, and material resources. Basically, to simplify things, money. All right? And now the idea is, what principles should we use in order to distribute these three kinds of goods? Now remember, and now I'm asking you to participate actively in this thought experiment if you're still with me, right? Are you still with me? So you don't know whether when the veil of ignorance is lifted, you will find yourself very fortunately endowed in both of these hierarchies, very fortunately situated socioeconomically, very fortunately situated with respect to the match between your talents and the reward system of the economy that you're a part of. You don't know whether you'll be way up on these hierarchies or completely at the bottom, right? So how would you think about the issue? What is the principle that you would choose if you were, what would be the rule of distribution that you would choose if you were placed in a position of radical uncertainty? Right? Would you suppose, first of all, that once the veil is lifted, you were at the top of these two hierarchies, or would you make the assumption that you were at the bottom?
Bottom.
That is exactly the way that Rawls reasons. Why is that? You want to protect yourself. It is rational, it is instrumentally rational in circumstances such as these to faire l'hypothèse du pire. Right? Let's assume the worst. The worst thing that could happen, after all, is that if I find myself at the bottom of the hierarchies, my situation is unlivable. Right? So these are very, very important decisions they're making. These are not decisions that are being made for one evening or for one afternoon. These are the rules that are going to structure our society's economy from now on. And so it is probably prudent, it is probably instrumentally rational to be risk-averse before all things and to assume, look, it would be really nice to be at the top of a distribution in a situation of radical inequality, but I'd better make the opposite assumption. Let's assume that when the veil is lifted, I will find myself at the very bottom and want to make sure that that position is as livable as possible. Now, so that's 5 points. Is there some kind of reward system where we give people extra points for giving the right answers? No? Apparently you get your money back, Vero just said. Now, if I am making that assumption, which is the one that Rawls thinks that we should make, what is the rule of distribution that I would be naturally inclined towards? What is the limit case of making the bottom as good as possible relative to the top?
Equality.
Right? The best that you can be, the best position that you can be in if you're at the bottom is at the limit for there not to be a bottom and for everybody to be equally situated. Right? Now Rawls says that assumption of equality is one that there is no reason to upset when we're talking about rights. Equal rights for all is an assumption that we can make, and then there's no reason to defeat that assumption. Right? There are some figures in the history of philosophy that have thought that rights should, that everybody should have rights, but that some people should have more rights than others. John Stuart Mill, who in other respects is one of my favorite philosophers, thought that the right to vote should be extended to everyone, including women, which was a fairly radical thing when he was writing, but that the educated should get a weighted vote, right? A more heavily weighted vote, because everyone would benefit if people like Allison and Stephen and myself got to have our votes multiplied by 5. The policies that would come out of our decisions would undoubtedly, right, be better. Now, I won't go into any detail about why that argument has been found wanting by generations of Democrats in the last 150 years. So the assumption of equality of rights is one that goes undefeated. The assumption of equality of opportunity is also one that goes undefeated. Right? The assumption that everyone, whether they are at the top or the bottom of the hierarchy, should have equal opportunities for success is one that we have no reason, once the veil is lifted, to put into question. Right? So we have equal opportunities and equal rights. Should we have equal resources? That's where Rawls thinks that from behind the veil of ignorance we would have slightly more complicated thoughts. The assumption of equality for Rawls is upset by the following thought. What if it turned out, and here I'm still speaking from the point of view of a person who's making the assumption that he or she will find themselves at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder or at the bottom of the distribution of talents. What if it turned out that if we allowed the people who, again, no credit to them, just happen to find themselves possessed of talents that are capable of generating more production, given the state of the economy at a particular time? What if we allowed them to benefit a little bit, and a little bit more than the others, from the fruits of their labor, from the fruits of their production? What if we incentivized them to work as hard as they could? What would happen is the pie of resources that we would get to distribute would get bigger, right? And if we have the right principles of distribution for that pie, I, making the assumption that I find myself at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, may end up with more than if I'd insisted on pure equality. Right? I may find myself in a situation of inequality relative to the better off, but I may still find myself with more than if I had insisted on equality. Because if we tell people who are more productive, look, whatever you do, we're all going to get the same amount of resources, the response that it is rational for them to provide is, you know what, I'd rather spend some time at home with my kids and, you know, making popcorn and watching movies rather than working hard to create riches that I won't get to benefit from. So we have to find a sweet spot, Rawls says. Doesn't actually use the term sweet spot, but we have to find a sweet spot, which is the following. How much redistribution can we affect on the basis of the greater production that we get from allowing people to benefit from their labor? You know, how much can we take from them before they have that reaction, before they say, you know what, I'm going to stop producing, right? So what is the point at which we're both benefiting people who are better off, more talented by allowing them to benefit from their labor, but still getting as much as we can for the purposes of redistribution? That's the point at which we should, if you're thinking about it from the point of view of the veil of ignorance, what Rawls calls the original position, that's the point at which you would want distribution of material resources to hit, right? And so there's the philosophical, and so this principle, which Rawls calls the difference principle, never really understood why he called it the difference principle, but that's what he called it, is the answer to the question that one of the most eminent philosophers of certainly the 20th century has given to the question of redistribution, right? Of how we redistribute. You know, we redistribute not to the point of equality, but in order to achieve this sweet spot. Now, I actually find Rawls's answer rather compelling. It's rather compelling. It is a very philosophically sophisticated. I've given you how many minutes? Probably too many already. How am I doing for time?
You're fine.
You know, I spent 18 years at a university across the hill where lectures are 3 hours long, and it became part of my DNA that when I open my mouth, I don't stop until 3 hours have passed, and it's a very hard habit to overcome, but Stephen will keep me in check to be sure. So I actually find that this is a rather compelling story, and I've given you only a sketch of the argument, but presumably some of you have also found it a fairly compelling story. The idea of the starting point, you know, we shouldn't allow people's undeserved assets at birth to determine the course of their lives is one that I think is fairly intuitive. The idea that you can operationalize this by asking people to reason on what the principles of justice should be, putting to one side, behind the veil of ignorance, where they happen to situate themselves with respect to these hierarchies, also fairly plausible. All the steps of the argument are, you know, you can quibble with this or that, but it's a fairly compelling story. And so as a philosopher, when I lived in a philosophy department, I thought, well, what is the division of labor between philosophy and the sort of stuff that Allison does? Well, we come up with the principles, and we deliver them unto a thankful set of, you know, plumbers in order to tell us just, you know, what it is that, how do we get there, right? So this is the goal, this is the principle, and you please design a tax regime that will allow us to realize, to achieve the tax principle. So one of the, I told you the short story of my lunch with Allison. The long version of the story is to tell you that one of the things that I've become convinced of is that as elegant and compelling as the story that I told you might be, not my telling of it, the story is elegant, my telling of it is whatever, but as compelling and elegant as the story that I've told you might be, it only answers at best one, maybe two of the questions, the philosophical questions that we need to address in order to arrive at the answers that we need in order to figure out what a just, not a just society, a just tax policy is. And so first of all, let me tell you what those two questions are. If you've bought my story so far, we've gotten something like the shape of what the just society should look like. When all the dust has settled, when policy has been allowed to take its course, a just society is one in which everyone will be able to look at their basket of resources and see that they correspond more or less to the difference principle. The people who are lower down on the economic spectrum will be able to say, you know what, I don't have as much as the people up there on the hill, but I have as much as I can be as I can expect to get under any feasible economic system, and more than if I insisted on a more egalitarian system. And the people at the top can say both that they are benefiting from what their labor has allowed them to produce, but also that they have, in a sense, achieved a certain degree of solidarity with their fellow citizens. So we have something like the goal. This is what society should look like if you followed me so far, if it's going to be distributively just. If it's going to be distributively just. So that's the first question that philosophy, at least in the Rawlsian picture, answers. The second question that it sort of answers, or that it begins to answer, is the question of why, right? The question of why we should try to achieve this kind of a goal. And the answer that it gives has something to do with luck. Right? That there's something, if you follow Rawls and if you follow people who have been influenced by Rawls, there's something galling, morally, when you think about it, at the extent to which people's courses through life are determined by things that they can claim absolutely no credit for, right? The circumstances of their birth and the circumstances of the genetic lottery. Think about it at the international scale. There is today something like a 40-year difference in life expectancy between a young person born in Sierra Leone or Liberia or Guinea and a person born either in Canada or Japan or one of the wealthiest countries. 40 years, half a life, at birth. You haven't even taken your first breath, and you already have a 40-year lesser life expectancy, to say nothing of the conditions in which you will be leading your life, just in virtue of having been born here rather than there. So there's something very deep, I would say, that offends us at the idea that luck, that things that have nothing to do with what people can take credit for, so powerfully shapes what people can expect from their lives. So the second question that is sort of answered by Rawls is, why do we want a society marked by something like the difference principle? Well, maybe we want it because we feel that luck should, at least to some degree, be neutralized in our social arrangements. At the very least, they shouldn't have a complete determinative impact on how people do. Okay, so so far I've told you the good news story about philosophy, and now I'll tell you a little bit about its very serious limitations. What it doesn't tell us at all is how to get there. What set of policies do we need to put into place in order to arrive at the just society as described by Rawls? Now, you might want to say, well, you've given an account of how question fits into the story. You've given the principles, and now the how is just a question of administration. It's just a question of plumbing. It's just a question of finding the right ways to implement a set of principles that can be fully spelled out at the level of philosophical first principle. And after a couple of months of giving this course with Allison, and a few months before that of prepping for it and reading it, I've now become convinced that that is just the wrong way of looking at the division of labor between philosophy and law and between law and philosophy. There are at least, I don't know how many of these I'm going to, what time do I have to shut up at?
Five to the hour,
and it's 6:38 now. Okay, we're doing well. There are at least five questions that I think are not just technical, administrative, policy question, but full-bloodedly philosophical questions that an account like Rawls leaves completely to the side, right? And I just want to run through what they are, and then that'll sort of set the stage for Allison, who will then tell you, you know, hopefully, reciprocally, why tax needs philosophy as well. The first is, why tax? Right? This institution that Stephen reminded us of, is so close to, it's part of the oxygen that we breathe, right? Why should we try to achieve the goal that I've spelled out with the Rawlsian principle through a practice like taxation, right? And once we've asked that question, how to tax? There are at least a couple of questions that fall under that rubric. Those of you who are tax lawyers here, I'll have to apologize for the sort of baby level at which I'll be discussing these things, but they are deep philosophical questions which I think need to be addressed. The how question has at least two dimensions. The first one has to do with what is it we tax, right? So we all know that those of us who aren't experts in tax know that we get taxed for just about everything we do. Our income debt gets taxed, capital gains get taxed, corporate profits get taxed, consumption gets taxed. Is there something at the level of principle that we could say about the right balance of levers, of taxation levers? Is it just a technical question whether we achieve the best balance of different tax policy instruments, whether the way that we distribute taxation across these domains? Or are there ethical questions, right, as well? And I think that there are ethical questions, because whether we tax consumption, whether we tax income, whether we tax, for those of you who have read the runaway intellectual bestseller of the last 20 years by Thomas Piketty, Capital in the 21st Century, Piketty is telling us that we really need to get our heads around is the idea that we should be taxing inherited wealth, capital, to a greater degree than we have, because that is really the motor of inequality throughout history, and it's one that we should focus on to a greater degree than we do either consumption or income. So what do we tax? And the second question is, how do we tax? How do we tax? What level of progressivity, if any, is the right level to reach? Again, there's an intuition here. The intuition is the more you make, right, the more you should contribute to the social pie. But the answer to that question is, well, proportionality gets us there as well. If you make $1 million and you get taxed to 10%, you'll be contributing $100,000 to the common weal, which is a lot more than that same 10% would get from somebody who only makes $20,000. So progressivity is something more than just the idea that people who make more should pay more, because you already get that through proportionality. So why progressivity? Again, is it just a technical question, or is there a deeper moral and philosophical question at play here? Just last week, we had a young philosopher from Université Laval by the name of Patrick Turmel, who introduced an idea, which is not a new idea, but he introduced it very compellingly, which is to say, I mean, what is the counter-argument to the progressivity view? What is the counter-argument? What kind of intuition funds the view that at the end of the day we should all pay proportionally rather than progressively? It's the argument from dessert, right? Dessert, not the thing that you have after dinner, but merit, right? The idea that, if I work hard, to tax me to a greater degree than you tax somebody who hasn't worked as hard, who hasn't produced as much, is punitive, right? It's not me doing my part to contribute to the common weal. It's downright punitive. The fact that I make more money, if the fact that I make more money means that I have to pay a greater proportion of my income than does someone who makes less, that means, in effect, that I'm being punished. So this intuition goes, for my greater productivity. And the idea that Patrick and the idea that, I think leads us into some very deep philosophical waters is the idea that that idea rests upon something which a couple of philosophers that we also studied in our course calls everyday libertarianism, right? The idea that your pre-tax income, the money that you make, right, as a lawyer or as a whatever, is something that you in some way deserve, right? And that when the state comes along and takes money away from you, it is perhaps necessarily, but nonetheless to some degree, impinging upon the principle of desert. And that is a principle that we shouldn't lose track of, according to this view, in the way that we design research tax regimes. Now, the answer to that question is, look, goes back to something that Barack Obama said in the last presidential campaign, which he got into some degree of trouble for. You know, if you've made a factory, right, you've benefited from the education system that has given you the educational know-how to know how to do the various things that you need to do in order to build a factory. You've driven on roads and had products delivered over bridges and rail systems. The inputs into your having been able to build a successful factory, which makes you rich, far exceed what you've been able to put in through your own labor, right? So, to some degree, you don't fully deserve that which you reap through your labor, because your labor is something that draws upon a range of inputs that is, in your past, that is around you, and that when we factor all of these things in, the principle of desert is one that we, to some degree, have to put into question. It's actually impossible if one were to try to say, well, okay, what proportion of my actual labor went into making the things that I make in my factory? Is it 23%? Is it 71%? It's actually impossible to disentangle, right, the endogenous and the exogenous, the internal and the external inputs that go into producing social, the fruits of cooperative surplus. And so the idea that, as it were, progressivity offends against some idea of desert, well, maybe we have to question that idea of desert as well. So there are at least a couple of questions, to sum up, that go into the how question that I talked about a second ago. There's the question of what to tax, right? And the question of how much to tax. Does it make sense? Is there something morally odious, as some people suggest, to punish people for making more money by taxing them at a higher level than people who make less? A final question, another question, sorry, and a question that I know that Allison has paid a lot of attention to, is a who question. Is a who question. Who do we tax? Right? So Rawls makes an assumption at the beginning of his book, which is an assumption. Philosophers like making simplifying assumptions. The idea being, look, you know, life is really, really complicated. And if we don't hold certain things constant, if we don't take certain ideas out of the, off the table, then, you know, it just becomes impossible. So he makes an assumption at the beginning of this book, A Theory of Justice, that I told you about, which is that we're talking about essentially a closed society. Rawls says, almost in so many words, that he is going to assume that societies are places in which people are born, live their lives, and die. Let's just bracket the absolutely obvious fact of migration, of emigration. And he does this for reasons which are practical. Look, I've already written a 600-page book making the simplifying assumption. If you want me to write a book that is going to release or, you know, take away the simplifying assumption, then you're not going to want to read it. But there's also another more technical reason, which I'll leave aside for the purposes of this discussion. If someone wants to hear about it for some reason, they can ask me in the question period. Real-world tax regimes cannot afford the luxury of state and social autarky. There are various facts about the way that people and things and capital move that make the question of who to tax extremely difficult. Allison will tell you in a few minutes, hopefully I'm not this is more like the teaser, the trailer, rather than you know, Allison will tell you in a minute, and some of you are possibly personally in a position to know this quite well, that the United States of America, for example, pretty much decides that, you know, if you're an American, if you've made money in America at some point, you may never set foot into that country again or work in that country again. You better you better file your taxes every year or else, right? So the United States have answered the question of who by saying, you know, everybody who is an American or everybody who has filed tax at some point, is that about right?
You're getting there.
Okay. Filed tax in the United States at some point has to do so in perpetuity, right? Whether they continue to work and make money and produce in the United States or not. What is the rationale behind that? Right? What is the rationale behind the obverse solution, which is to tax people who are on your territory, whether they are or aren't members of your national community? Right? Again, there are deep philosophical questions about who we are, who the we is, the members of which have duties of solidarity to one another, which tax regimes really presuppose, but don't necessarily have fully worked out philosophical 5 minutes left theories to answer. So another thing that's true of the world in which we live, quite different from the world in which John Rawls sort of supposes that we live, is that it's not just people that can move. Stuff moves as well. Stuff, productive capacities, capital, moves around all the time, and it moves around even more frenetically in a period of globalization. Globalization perhaps can even be defined as the greater ease and therefore the greater frequency with which things, people, capital move around and find themselves outside, potentially, of the taxing reach of the state. Right? What is the moral relationship that obtains between a society and somebody who earns a lot of money there, but who has managed to offshore various components of the companies that he or she owns in ways that seem to put them beyond the reach of taxation. There's something here that has been at the core of a lot of philosophical reflection for hundreds of years that has to do with what I want to call the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, right? The letter of the law is what is written down black on white on paper, right? The spirit of the law is sort of the reasons that those things were written down. Unfortunately, the letter of the law is what we have to go with, and it creates for people who are creative and ingenious tax lawyers, for example, all kinds of ways, a veritable how-to of not how to evade tax, but how to avoid tax. Right? To what degree should we be worried, ethically, philosophically, about this gap between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, when the letter of the law seems to allow, especially in circumstances of globalization, for as much avoidance behavior as it seems to? And this leads to the last question that I will raise, which seems to me to be, again, an eminently philosophical question, which is basically this. Philosophers tend to have the following kind of attitude about, or the following kind of view presupposed about the relationship between the state and citizens. Again, Rawls makes the simplifying assumption, which he refers to as full compliance. Let's assume that we're living in a society where people basically act on the basis of the laws that have been enacted for them, assuming that they view the process through which these laws have been enacted as legitimate, right? They comply. Now, something which I think is obvious in all areas of the law, but perhaps particularly in tax law, is that people don't just receive the laws and rules that the state announces, thankfully, by saying, thank you for these laws that allow for the cooperative coexistence of so many different people. We will obey them according to their letter and according to their spirit. They react strategically to them. The laws that are put forward by the state may elicit compliance from certain people, may elicit law-breaking from others, but somewhere in the mushy middle, there's also this very interesting range of phenomena, which is strategic reactions to the law. Maybe a fine that that the state puts forward in order to prohibit a certain behavior is viewed as a price by certain agents, and now I'm down to zero. What do we do about the fact that in the real world, the relationship between the state and its citizens is not one of blind obedience or of even reasoned obedience, but one of strategic interactions? Is that something that should change the nature of the way in which we think about tax policy? So I'm going to end there because I've been told to by Stephen, and I'm actually kind of still a little scared of him. So I hope I've convinced you that philosophy needs law in order to join in the process of making just tax policy, because the questions that it asks are really incomplete unless they join hands with the kinds of questions that actually looking at tax regimes, tax policies, the laws that create the tax regimes that we live in actually impose upon us. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks so much. We will have a Q&A in a couple of minutes, but we're supposed to join issue a bit here on some of these matters. What struck me a bit was how all this works out in terms of our institutions and electoral politics in this country, and you have a certain number of polls. There are clearly one poll or voices at work which say that if you are an individual and a member of the society, let's say a Canadian citizen and resident, you have an inherent right to at least basic sustenance, but that is assumed by and large to go further, a reasonable standard of living, so social welfare should, possibly regardless of your behavior, and even if you choose not to work in its more radical forms, pay you. And on the other hand, you have reflections of, let's say, the more traditional view at one time, the idea of the deserving poor. So those who, for no fault of their own, cannot help themselves should have some measure of social assistance. And this seems to work itself out in our Canadian institutional terms in a reasonable consensus between left and right, which produces a social safety net, perhaps a bit more generous than that in the United States, and a little less polarized politically. And so that's why we're able to work. But you see at the edges, for example, on the expansion or contraction of social welfare in Quebec and what the rules are and how restrictive it's become. And over time, in recent decades, more restrictions have been imposed. So you see these issues at work there. And so I'll leave it at that for the moment and not get very far into the general anti-avoidance rule, which I'm very tempted to, because I believe that public policy at the federal level, and this was introduced by the Mulroney government, a conservative government, has the posture has been, the position has been, that we can no longer operate simply by the rule of law. You read the statute, you apply the statute, and you're taxed or not. So that if you read the statute and you see it's not taxed, and you engage in a transaction that's not taxed, you do it because it's not taxed, then you are taxed, right? And so the principle that everyone is entitled to act with the knowledge of and regard to the law, not the more so that it's a tax law, because I don't regard this as especially a matter for taxation, but not the less that it's the tax law, goes by the board, because the taxpayers and their counsel, including I hope a lot of people here, are thought to be just too clever, and no matter what they write, it is likely to be more costly to the fisc than should be the case. And I'll just leave it by saying that one of these continuing ed courses given many, many years ago by the late Phil Weinberg started off by saying there is no mind so fiendish that it could at one sitting have conceived the present provisions of the Income Tax Act relating to corporate surpluses. And I just thought that was wonderful, because of course it was a result of taxpayers' avoidance schemes and legislative responses and more avoidance schemes and more responses. So it got more and more complex till it reached a point where no mind could have conceived of it from the outset. And I said, that's my ambition, to become a mind so fiendish that it could have conceived of such a provision. Of course, I've not yet reached that point, and I'm unlikely to. But at any rate, that kind of is a secret ambition I've harbored. So what does Allison have to say about all this? Your thoughts?
Mine? I thought you were going to answer that.
No, no, but
you've
got to talk back and forth
a
little bit.
Yeah.
If you have a thought, go ahead.
I'll just say something about the first part, but you're getting all prepped there. So
no,
I'm ready, but go
ahead.
You go. So one of the things that the first part of Steve's, in bringing up the idea of the deserving poor. So one of the, you know, going into a little bit of the deeper philosophical recesses of this issue, so one of the things that's interesting in philosophy is that, philosophers who work in the path that's sort of been traced by somebody like John Rawls actually end up taking quite a view about personal responsibility that is probably quite counterintuitive to the person in the street. So there's a lot of polling about how people feel about the notion of desert, right? Should you, how important should desert, personal responsibility, desert be in the way that we distribute the fruits of social cooperation? Desert is a very robust notion in people's minds. And so the idea of the deserving poor, you know, the people, there are people who on the one hand, are trying, they're getting out, going out every day, trying to find a job, and they just can't despite their best efforts. And then there are the others who just lay back, have given up, and watch, TV all day long and just wait for the checks to come in. So, you know, when you push the idea of luck to its furthest sort of philosophical recesses, you get the following thought. You know, think about the people that you know around you who are who are strivers, who expend a lot of effort and personal responsibility. And think about the ones who are perhaps to a greater degree slackers. You know, you could probably, if you told their stories, point to something in their upbringing. You know, the one happened to meet a teacher who, and the other one just never had anybody who. You know, there's always something external to the individual that accounts for some people seeming more deserving and others seeming less deserving. So I think that one of the great sort of divides between thinking about these issues philosophically and thinking about them from the point of view of the way in which we tend to think about them in everyday life is just how powerful the idea of individual desert is when you do polling, when you do experimental economic sort of exercises, who should get what, when you do kind of experimental economics. And yet, you know, it is a notion that tends to evanesce. You know, I noticed a lot of people nodding. I hope they weren't nodding off. But I saw a lot of people nodding as I sort of told this story about, you know, wanting to neutralize the effects of luck in society. Well, as you're nodding, you have to realize that perhaps to some degree, the degree to which we are more or less well disposed to expend effort, right, to do the types of things that qualify us as deserving or not, is itself due to something, to things that are part of our background for which we can't necessarily claim credit. So that's just a sort of long-winded way, well, it's especially long-winded, of saying that, you know, this idea of the deserving poor is one that just doesn't really resonate with the framework that I've been talking about. Stop there.
So I'll just weigh in with a couple of things. I know that we want to open up for a Q&A, so I won't talk too long. But I think that one of the most compelling pieces of that that description that you give is that we don't know exactly what each person's contribution to the whole is attributable to what aspect of their character or their aspect of their labor. So we have a really difficult time measuring. We can say you are poor, but we don't know if you have contributed in a different way than with monetary resources. And so that comes out in, again, you mentioned Patrick Turmel. But so I often like to flip this question on its head. When we talk about the social safety net, we never seem to be talking about corporate welfare, but that's a social safety net too, isn't it? And when we think about what we spend to support business, entrepreneurship, and especially multinational business, this is very much a social safety net for Canadian businesses, which we do not think of as welfare and do not count as a support for a deserving recipient who is not poor, who is in fact rich. So that question about dessert is really fascinating when, if we say when in the who question, that in our society we don't just have you and me and our individual capacities, but we pool together in enterprises through the business form, and that business form has become a person in our society who is the beneficiary of largesse, which we deliver through the tax code. So we'll come back to, I hope we'll have time to come back to that. And I know Stephen's showing me zero, which could be the amount of content I just delivered, or could be that I have to wait until after the break to give you more. Thank you.
Okay, it's now open to the floor, and so we welcome your thoughts, comments, critiques. Yes?
We have to use the microphone.
My question is, the author that you discussed tonight, how did he distribute the extra benefits that he must have made from selling so many 600-page books? I think that's a practical question to somebody who's preaching.
Possibly through taxation.
Do you want to bundle questions together, or
no.
One by one? I have to talk into the mic, though.
It's easier to remember.
So the first thing that I'll say is that, you know, even a book that an academic book that gets translated in a lot of languages doesn't actually get, you know, that doesn't amount to all that much. You know, we're not talking Harry Potter sales numbers here. And we're probably not even talking, you know, Margaret Atwood sales numbers. Academic books, I doubt that John Rawls made himself particularly rich. I mean, you know, Rawls was always extremely clear about the fact that he felt that American society was going in the wrong direction in terms of, you know, policies, especially from the early 80s on, that had as an effect to accentuate and polarize inequalities rather than doing anything to remedy them. I mean, this is sort of a personal question, but you know, I spent a year working with Rawls at Harvard in the late 80s, and he was someone who Despite the fact that as a Harvard professor, I imagine he made quite a lot of money. He was extremely frugal in his own personal habits. There was a lunch that graduate students gratefully went to because they were paid for at the faculty club of Harvard University. And he would bring cucumber sandwiches to lunch rather than eating off of the, the largesse of whoever it was that was providing the lunch. Cucumber sandwiches and these little pots of yogurt, I can always see them. His sartorial mode suggested that he also wasn't spending a lot of money, buying flashy clothes. So, I think that there's, was he sending the most of his proceeds to, the poor? I don't know. I wouldn't know how to answer the question. But I think that, to go back to what I was saying, you have to realize that an academic bestseller and a bestseller are two very different things.
I think Piketty is making a lot of money out of his books. It's gone into several printings, and it's being gobbled up by Wall Street and by everyone else. So maybe we should see him about taxation. And speaking of cucumber sandwiches, one of our alums who's in practice downtown is a Princeton graduate and worked in the grill when he was a Princeton student. And the famous mathematician John Nash of A Beautiful Mind would come in every day for lunch and have two grilled hot dogs. Okay, so
maybe that's what you need to do in order to achieve your intellectual ambition.
Exactly.
Becoming the mind.
Okay, other questions? My eyesight is poor, so gesticulate wildly. Okay, there's somebody up there.
Bonsoir. J'aimerais vous entendre parler du principe d'égalité des chances et de la fiscalité du système de santé.
La fiscalité du système de santé?
Oui.
Est-ce que vous pourriez en dire un peu plus parce que la question est tellement...
Ben, c'est difficile à résumer, là. Disons que quand on parle de un exemple pratique... Oui. Certains choix en matière de santé, ou on peut parler de choix ou de manque de chance. J'essaie de résumer un peu ma pensée, mais on a décidé, par exemple, au Canada, qu'on avait une couverture universelle et qu'on taxait les gens en conséquence.
Oui.
J'aimerais vous entendre parler de ce principe-là, oui, qui provient du fait qu'on dit, bien évidemment, on doit couvrir... on doit couvrir les frais de santé pour absolument tout le monde, peu importe, et justement partant du fait qu'il y en a qui naissent avec, oui, moins de chances que d'autres,
oui,
ou plus de maladies que d'autres, et on voit qu'il y a une croissance exponentielle des coûts, et il se trouve certains systèmes pour dire que ben c'est pas que une inégalité à la base, mais plutôt une conséquence des choix,
okay,
si on a à payer pour certaines personnes,
okay,
et donc...
Oui. Il y a tellement de dimensions à votre question que je vais répondre à l'une d'entre elles. Puis si Stephen n'a pas encore acheté son mouchoir avec le zéro, je vais peut-être aborder une seconde. Alors, il y a quelque chose de très intéressant. Prenons un exemple qui est celui du tabagisme. Les études sur le tabagisme dans tous les pays démontrent qu'il y a une très forte corrélation entre le statut socio-économique et le tabagisme. Donc, pour dire les choses de manière un peu simpliste, mais qui correspond quand même à peu près au fait, plus on est pauvre, plus il y a des chances qu'on fume. Donc, encore une fois, et le problème est que pour les gens qui ont déjà fumé. Moi, je viens d'une famille de classe ouvrière, j'ai déjà fumé parce que j'idolâtrais mon père et mon père fumait des exportés. Je les vois encore et je les sens encore et je me disais que pour être comme mon père, il fallait que je fume des exportés. La probabilité qu'on va fumer quand on... Oublions les questions de fumée secondaire, là, qui est un autre... Les probabilités qu'on va fumer quand on est dans un environnement où des gens fument est beaucoup plus élevée. Donc, il y a des phénomènes, disons, socio-économiques qui sont en quelque sorte renforcés génération après génération. Beaucoup plus difficile pour une personne de classe... Enfin, les statistiques, là, c'est pas quelque chose que j'affirme comme ça, mais les statistiques nous démontrent très clairement qu'il y a une distribution extrêmement inégale, linéaire et inégale, du tabagisme à travers les statuts socio-économiques. Donc, les choix...
Encore une fois, dans quelle mesure y a-t-il choix et dans quelle mesure y a-t-il impact de facteurs qui dépassent l'individu? Je pense qu'il y a un peu des deux. Hein. Je ne veux pas complètement dédouaner les gens qui font des choix qui sont délétères à leur santé. L'autre chose que je dirais, c'est que une des raisons pour lesquelles on insiste sur une couverture universelle, c'est que malgré la prévisibilité ou les corrélations quand même relativement fortes entre certains types de comportements et certains types de résultats au niveau de la santé, il y a néanmoins une part d'imprévisibilité. Hein, tout le monde connaît probablement mon beau-père était un homme qui était qui courait des marathons et qui est mort du cancer du poumon à 62 ans n'ayant jamais fumé une cigarette de sa vie. Donc il y a un degré d'imprévisibilité qui fait de sorte que le risk pooling a du sens, même pour ceux qui se disent, moi je fais tous les bons choix, je mange sainement, je fais de l'exercice, je fume pas, je fais pas de sport dangereux, etc. On en sait encore suffisamment peu sur la santé pour pouvoir, pour qu'il soit rationnel, même pour des gens qui font les bons choix, de se désolidariser du lot social, parce que rien n'empêche qu'une personne qui est en parfaite santé du point de vue de ses choix se retrouve à 35 ans avec un fardeau de santé qui exige qu'elle puise dans le pool de ressources communes que nous avons créé à travers une assurance publique. Je ne sais pas si j'ai répondu à votre question. Oui, oui. Oui.
Mais qu'est-ce qu'on fait avec cet argument-là? Parce que c'est bien beau, là. Moi, je parle assez fort. Hein. On me reproche souvent de parler fort chez moi, mais en tout cas. Mais non, ce que je veux dire, c'est que c'est un argument qu'on entend souvent qui motive souvent les gens à ne pas payer leurs impôts parce que. Regarde leur voisin. Pourquoi je paierais pour lui? Il fait pas ce qu'il faut dans la vie. Alors, on part du principe de, oui, taxons les gens pour venir en aide aux gens qui ont moins de chances dans la vie. Mais dans les faits, on dirait que psychologiquement, dans la population, ça ne marche pas, cet argument-là.
Psychologiquement, alors là je sais pas s'il y a des... je suis d'accord avec vous que psychologiquement... ça marche pas très fort. Cela dit, je reviendrai à une des choses que j'ai dit tout à l'heure dans la réalité quand on contribue à n'importe quelle, que ce soit une assurance d'ailleurs d'État ou une autre assurance, on paye non seulement pour les autres, on paye pour soi-même également. Hein. On paye pour que, quand on en a besoin, on puisse tirer des ressources communes. Et l'autre chose que je dirais, c'est que, encore une fois, nous ne sommes pas arrivés dans une position relativement privilégiée en n'ayant fait aucun retrait, en quelque sorte, du fonds commun. Donc, je pense que c'est vrai que ce sont des attitudes qui sont extrêmement robustes dans la population. L'idée que ce que je fais comme salaire, je le mérite et que c'est du vol quand l'État me le prend, c'est quelque chose... Bon, il y a Tax Freedom Day, là, à toutes les années, il y a Tax Freedom Day, comme si c'était seulement au jour, je ne sais pas, à peu près about halfway through the year, qu'on était littéralement libéré d'un fardeau qui est, on présuppose, injuste. Right, there's no mortgage freedom day. Yeah, exactly. That's a good. I know that these. Je sais que ces idées sont extrêmement robustes dans la population. Comment les déstabiliser? À travers les arguments comme ceux que je vous ai présentés, mais je crois que la psychologie est souvent immunisée par rapport à la force des arguments. Les gens ont énormément de mécanismes de défense, même contre les bons arguments. Ça, je le sais. Donc, j'ai pas vraiment de lumière à vous proposer pour savoir comment surmonter. On a déjà du droit et de la philosophie. Là, ça te prendrait de la psychologie sociale. Mais ce sont des questions extrêmement importantes. Les stratégies adoptées, in a way, it goes back to stuff that we've been talking about in class. So, yeah.
On a le temps pour une autre question, je crois, si autrement on procéderait au break.
Well, now you're no. Oh, okay.
D'abord, merci beaucoup, Daniel, pour cet exposé absolument remarquable.
What's your philosopher's take on the public pension reform? And I'm not going to ask you for an answer as to what would you do to fix that thing, because that's too complex. But what's the philosophical framework to help us think about what I think is a huge challenge, not here only in Quebec but elsewhere, differently than the kind of debates and arguments we've been exposed to?
That's a very good question. Clearly, our pension systems were based on a set of assumptions when they were set up, which have proven to be completely mistaken from the point of view of demography, et cetera. And now, we have to find a way of keeping the pension system afloat whilst having people who in the system who have been paying into the system according to the old rules. So you have two principles that are really kind of in. You have a kind of collective good principle, which how do we make sure that this system is viable for generations to come? And then a kind of contract. You can't change the rules in mid course. It seems to me to be one of the hardest issues that we have to face. I think that the only way to face it is by really feeling the weight of both of those principles and giving them some kind of equal weight in deliberation. Now, I think that as a matter of armchair social psychology, I think that people are willing to make sacrifices to a greater degree, perhaps, if they feel like they have been consulted in the process of making the sacrifices. People are willing to compromise to a greater degree if they feel that the procedure through which the compromises have been articulated and defined is one that has given them voice. And I think that one of the problems that we may be facing today is one in which a lot of the people feel that there's been a certain level of high-handedness in the way in which this necessary tension, which we can't avoid, has been dealt with. And, it might be worth seeing if a more consultative approach might not allow us to bridge the two principles that I've sort of formulated to a greater degree than a logic of confrontation would. It's a very, very difficult situation. I mean, we're constantly facing, and I'll end with this, we're constantly facing all kinds of policy issues where we realize that the assumptions on the basis of which the policies were made were mistaken. I'll give an example which may seem to have nothing to do. The last time I was up here talking, I was talking about the debate around Bill 52, right? And one of the things that the law, as it's been enacted, sort of makes very plain right on its face is, look, the institutional mechanisms that we have here may need to be fine-tuned, right? After a year, we'll see whether or two years, we'll see whether the empirical assumptions about the numbers of people who will ask for physician-assisted death is about what we estimate. And if it's not, if it's way too much, if all of a sudden thousands of people are asking to be, euthanized by their physicians, we'll tighten and we'll have kind of a, and this is, I think, just good public policy, that once you have public policy, you don't just sort of go away and assume that everything's fine. You have to have some, sort of empirical retroaction. But I think that here, this is just good public policy 101, but here that mechanism hits up against the fact that people have very, very powerfully and deeply articulated their expectations for the future on the basis of a certain set of assumptions. So there's perhaps more of a moral argument for locking those sets of empirical assumptions in place, although from the point of view of broader public utility, it probably doesn't make any sense. So, one of the things that you learn in philosophy is when you don't know the answer to the question, you just re-say the problem in ways that sound kind of intelligent. And I'm aware of the fact that maybe that's a little bit what I've done with the intelligence set aside. But, that's what I would say at this point.
Doyen Bélanger, I think, or did you want to? Okay, I think it's time for the break. So do you want to make an announcement about how when we get back and so on?
We'll be back in 15 minutes.
Thank you very much.
A colleague, Professor Christians, whom I consider the Pied Piper of tax because huge numbers of highly motivated citizens walked down the corridor when we were in old Chancellor de Hoe, we're temporarily out of there, to her office, all open, always open door. Highly motivated students in large numbers, and it was a kind of a cult or Pied Piper phenomenon. But Professor Christians will give you a discussion of international tax issues.
Thank you so much. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I want to segue by saying that you have heard, I think, a vindication of why I want to hear Professor Weinstock, as a philosopher, talk about taxation. What? Higher? Good? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me in the back? Don't fall asleep. When Professor Weinstock starts talking about tax, I start listening. And when a lot of people start talking about tax, I find it hard to listen, because they're never talking about the thing I want them to talk about. So that's my segue. And what I want to do is take you through a real-life example of why the questions that Professor Weinstock raised, why are we taxing, how are we taxing, but most especially, who are we taxing, and this link between the state and the citizen lying in compliance, I want to take you through a real-life example, which I think will upset some of you and embolden others. We'll see. So I gave you this title to both confuse and alarm you. When local is foreign, the implications of FATCA in Canada. Is anyone here aware of FATCA, the acronym? Do you know what it is? Is anyone? Oh, we do have a couple of unfortunate souls. Okay. It stands for the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. It is not Canadian law, so why are we talking about it here? So I'm going to tell you the basic framework, how it became a conversation about citizenship and especially Canadian citizenship, and what's going to happen next. All right, I'm going to try to walk you through something that's technically ridiculous. It's ridiculous. No one should have to learn this. But you have to learn it because it involves these very basic, fundamental questions about who belongs to whom and who has claims against whom in our societies. All right. So what's the basic problem? Well, you may have been watching the news. Well, you wouldn't know this one, but you would know this one. You may have been watching the news and seen UBS and Tax Evader put together in a sentence more than once. And you may know that the U.S. is on a mission, dare I say crusade, to wipe out Swiss banking for Americans. And the issue is that rich Americans hide their money offshore. So how do you stop that? Well, what's the problem with rich Americans hiding their money offshore? Well, Daniel, you talked about what does this tell us about a just society when you are trying to figure out who's the poor and who's the rich and who's got obligations to the other. So we get to from UBS to FATCA by saying that states have to be accountable to their people, that the tax system has to be viewed as fair, otherwise politicians risk their privileges. So I think if it really is obviously unfair the way we tax rich people, they don't pay tax, but I pay tax. People who don't earn income, they don't pay tax, but I pay tax on my wages. I'm going to start getting mad at my politicians, and politicians don't like us, don't like it when we get mad at them, and so they have to change the rules, and that's really what's at stake. Whether it's fair or not fair, it's really about politicians keeping their seats. That I realize I have exposed some of my cynicism. Perhaps you'll forgive me for it. But it means that at the end of the day, we sort of have this idea that we have to sort of ask the same of all taxpayers, and we have to sort of impose the same system on all taxpayers, not the same tax or get the same amount of money, but the same set of rules on all of our taxpayers. And UBS is embarrassing. We've got a system that some taxpayers opt out of with impunity to the tune of billions of dollars. That's embarrassing for politicians. It's also inconvenient when your economy is crumbling and you can't find the money to fix roads or educate children, and UBS and all of their clients are running around thumbing their noses at your system because they don't have to follow your rules. They're far too rich. You know, the old The old quote attributed to the hotel magnate, only the little, we don't pay taxes, only the little people pay taxes, when your whole system is built around just shoving that in people's faces over and over, people get mad, politicians say, we've got to do something. What are we going to do? Well, let's use this as an opportunity to score some political points. Let's crack down on tax evaders. Let's get elected on a campaign that we're going to clean up this town, doggone it. How are we going to do it? We're going to enact something we call the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. We're going to enact it as a revenue raiser. That is, we're going to shove it in a bill with which it has nothing in common with anything else the bill accomplishes. We're going to shove it in at midnight, and we're going to say, we're putting this in here to pay for the stuff you want. Schools, roads, you know, child care. We're going to put this in here. This is where the money's coming from. It's coming from tax evaders. You know, all those people you really hate. Okay? So you can have all the things you want. All we have to do is find the tax evaders. Stated goal of FATCA, by the people who put it into law, stop Americans, and I put that in quotes for a reason, because some of you in this room are Americans. You're going to find out, and it's going to scare you. Hiding cash offshore, that's the word we're using, we keep it in mind, by forcing foreign banks, which is to say all banks in the world that are not in the United States, to act as third-party reporters and what we call withholding agents. Now, in tax, we love withholding agents. You all know those guys. They're the person that stand between the money you were promised by your employer and what is actually written on your paycheck. That's your withholding agent. That's the person who holds money on your behalf and pays it to the crown. Guess what? Not your money. It's the Crown's money under law. It's kind of a fun little detail in the Canadian tax law that you have no right to it. When your employer withholds, pays it over to the Crown, you can't complain that something's been taken from you. So we're going to find those third-party reporters, and they're going to have to pay us, or they're going to have to, you know, keep this system working. All right. Well, why would FATCA work? Well, let's just think about what we're asking. We have a global financial system that relies heavily on U.S. dollars. All U.S. dollars must flow through U.S. financial institutions. You cannot operate in U.S. dollars without going through the U.S. So there's a soft power to regulate the global financial system via the threat of sanctions. Okay? So under FATCA, that's what we'll do. If you're not a U.S. institution, you must register with the IRS. You must get a global identification number, and you must make three promises to the IRS, and here they are. You're going to do a bunch of due diligence. We'll tell you what, when, how, and how much. You're going to do withholding payments. We'll tell you how much and as to who. You're going to do annual reporting. It's going to be extensive. You're not going to like it, but you're doing it. Now, the architects of FATCA must have realized that when you tell, for example, Desjardins that they have to do all these things, Desjardins might say, I am not yours. You may not regulate me. I am not in the United States. Forget you. Noncompliance will be punished with a 30% penalty on U.S. source cash flows to all financial institutions in the world. And I want you to know that this is not an income tax, because the penalty will be imposed even if it's not income. That is, it'll be imposed on gross sales proceeds. And it will be imposed even if you don't owe any tax. So that's a sanction. That's an economic sanction that the United States has levied on all of the world through the international financial system. And Desjardins will comply and is complying. What's that got to do with you? Well, you've got some agreements in place. You'd think we can work together if the U.S. wants something. They don't have to shake a stick at us. We're their neighbor, and we're nice. So how is FATCA going to work? Well, let's just see. It's a U.S. law aimed at non-U.S. third parties who hold customers' money and financial assets. So anyone in Canada who holds customers' money and financial assets. will be punished with these eye-popping penalties if they don't do one of two things: ensure their customers are not U.S. persons, or if they are U.S. persons, tell the IRS about their assets and gross income. So we've got a project, Canada does, as does the rest of the world. We've got to divide the global population into U.S. persons and not U.S. persons. It doesn't matter if the not U.S. person is Canadian, Swedish, French, German. It doesn't matter. Not U.S. What we have to do together is divide the global population, U.S. persons and not U.S. persons. And who has to do that? Our financial institutions have to do that, all of them. Also trusts, personal, family. Also businesses, if someone's signing accounts who is a U.S. person. Then you're a reporter, you're a third-party reporter. Getting worried yet? So we want to know, who are these third parties who are going to have to do this reporting, withholding, and all of this jazz? How are they going to ensure their customers are not U.S. persons? And what will they have to do if they think their customers are U.S. persons? Who are these third parties? The main one is called foreign financial institutions. A foreign financial institution includes anyone who holds money on account of someone else, anyone who has signature authority on an account of someone else. Is that you? That might be you. Powers of attorney are financial institutions in the U.S. law. A trust, which is not an entity and is not a person, is a foreign financial institution in U.S. law. An FFI, a foreign financial institution, is any non-U.S. entity that accepts deposits, holds financial assets, invests or trades financial assets as a business, for example, a mutual fund, or is an insurance company. And there are others, but we'll focus on these. It's bad enough with these, right? Okay, what do they have to do? Well, they have to ask new customers to sign documents saying they're not U.S. persons. And they have to search existing accounts for indicia of U.S. person status. And they only have to do this once the accounts exceed $50,000 for individuals, $250,000 for entities, and $250,000 for life insurance. But they can search all accounts, and anecdotal evidence suggests that TD and Scotiabank are doing just that. So 1 cent in an account, they're looking for U.S. indicia, and you will get a letter. Some of you will get it soon, that says, we've noticed you're a U.S. person. We have to turn you over to the IRS. Under the IGA, an agreement that we have between Canada and the United States, financial institutions don't have to search government-sponsored accounts. These include your RRSP, your RESP, your RDSP, your TFSA. Please do not feel too confident. All of these are taxable under the U.S. system, unless you make extensive reporting reporting obligations, and you make you choose to use an exemption. You have to make a lot of you have to put in a lot of paperwork to get them to not be taxable. But I'll tell you what, there's a lot of discussion about your TFSA and your RDSP and your RESP going on right now, and there's a lot of uncertainty. Okay. If the bank finds indicia, they're going to ask customers to provide documents showing or stating that they're not U.S. persons. This is really interesting, right? How do you prove a negative? You will be fascinated to find out. What's the FFI looking for? All right. So here's the indicia. Here's what, if you find it, if someone finds it in a document, you're a U.S. person. You may be a U.S. person if you are identified as a U.S. citizen or resident. Resident is a defined term that no one defines. You're born in the U.S. We're coming back to this again, because in terms of luck egalitarianism, this is it, baby. This is luck. For a lot of people born in the 1950s, when the closest hospital was in the United States, but they lived in Canada, you better believe this is bad luck. A U.S. telephone number will tell your bank you're a U.S. person. A U.S. residence or mailing address will tell the bank the trust fund, the business, you're a U.S. person. Standing instructions to transfer funds to a U.S.-based account, do not send your children to school in the United States and send them money. That makes you a U.S. person. Am I bothering you yet? Indications of a power of attorney over the account to a person with a U.S. address, indicia that you're a U.S. person. A care of or hold mail address as the sole address, indicia that you're a U.S. person. Okay. Just to reiterate, for individuals with an account of $50,000 to $1 million, the financial institution only has to search their data in electronic records, what's already in the computer. So there's a lot of Canadians thinking to themselves, what did I show when I opened my account? What's in their computer? What did they type in to a database? Over $1 million, the financial institution must search paper records as well. So over the summer, McGill Law students, Concordia Law students, students at UDM were hired to look at your bank account records, to read all of them, to look, search for U.S. indicia. Your personal, private, financial information of every Canadian citizen with an account in Canada has been looked at by someone looking for this information. If you don't feel a little violated by that, then I might just be out of touch. But I feel like maybe you might feel a little violated by that. Am I right? Especially when I tell you that there is no limit. Nobody's checking to make sure no one walks away with a UBS stick. Nobody's checking to make sure no one's scanning things. What is in those files? A 22-year-old knows. A lot of 22-year-olds know. Just to be clear, you can search everything. You don't have to search those paper files until you have a million, but you can go ahead and search everything if you want to be on the safe side. And let me tell you something, financial institutions do want to be on the safe side of the IRS for good reason. What will they do if they find these indicia? Well, I'm really sorry about this, but this is about to get just painfully technical. It's not my fault. I think it's written so that no one can understand it, and they did not think I would read it and explain it to you. In order to understand this, you first have to know what a few things are. One, you need to know what a withholding certificate is. You need to know what a certificate of loss of nationality is. You need to know what proof of foreign, that is to say, not U.S., citizenship is. And you need to know what a proof of claim of foreign status is. Withholding certificate. Here it is. It's called a W-8-B-E-N. It used to be 2 pages. Well, actually, at one point, it was half a page. And then it was 2 pages. Now it's 13. You are not to use this form if you are a U.S. citizen or other U.S. person. You see that word, U.S. person? Not defined. Including a resident alien individual. You're going to have to read some law. You are going to have to talk to a lawyer. You might want to have to talk to an immigration lawyer in the United States to be able to sign this form. Now you might say, whatever, they're just asking me a question. Going to fill it out to the best of my ability? No, you're not, because you're going to sign this under penalties of perjury. In Canadian law, no. You're going to sign this under penalties of perjury in U.S. law, and this form is being furnished to you by your Canadian financial institution. If that doesn't worry you a little bit, then I don't have the room anymore. But I think I have the room. Under penalties of perjury, you're going to sign away your understanding of U.S. immigration law as it applies to you. And you are going to certify that you are not a citizen, not any of these other things, a U.S. person, which you don't know what that means. Oh, sorry. That's your withholding certificate. Next, your certificate of loss of nationality, what some people have taken to calling the freedom card. The certificate of loss of nationality is not something that you certify to. It's so weird. It's something that somebody, apparently anybody, the janitor perhaps, at an embassy, signs under penalties of perjury to say that you are not a U.S. citizen because you've renounced. to renounce your citizenship, you must go into a U.S. embassy, you must indicate your intention to renounce, you must pay a $2,350 fee, and you must certify that you have been compliant with U.S. tax laws for the last 5 years. When you do all of those things, you can have this certificate of loss of nationality. However, you're going to have to wait because there's a backlog at every embassy in Canada and you can't get an appointment for 6 months. On the certificate of loss, don't you love my punchlines? The certificate of loss of nationality is the embassy person certifying that, the best of their knowledge and belief, you have done an action causing an expatriation, and this was performed voluntarily, and you are expatriated. There's a lot of law in here. And you know what? The U.S. does not want you to do this. In 2009, the fee for renouncing was zero. In 2010, the State Department instituted the fee the same year that FATCA was enacted. The fee was initially $400. They went through notice and comment. They got all kinds of complaints. They put it in anyway. This year we were told, well, it's so much work to renounce all these people that want to renounce that we've got to quintuple the fee. Get your CLN now because that fee's going up. They are now saying that fee, $2,350, is a quarter of what it actually costs the U.S. to let you go. And you have to pay it. How do you prove a negative? It's really hard to prove someone's not a U.S. person when you're not a lawyer specializing in U.S. immigration law, but every person who has a FATCA withholding obligation in Canada will have to do just this. And they're going to start relying on government documents as sufficient proofs. This is kind of fascinating if it wasn't so Kafkaesque. Proof of foreign citizenship is necessary. That's a government-issued ID that evidences citizenship. You know what that is for you? For most people, it's your passport. It might be a card that shows your citizenship. For example, if you have a child that was born outside of Canada, you can get a card for that child that says they're a Canadian citizen. Proof of claim of foreign status is a little bit lower burden of proof. A certificate of residence from a tax authority, like the Quebec Revenue Agency saying you reside in Quebec, a government-issued ID like a driver's license, and a proof similar certificate. Now, I want you to let the wash of documents, you know, just kind of flow over you. You've got a withholding certificate where you certify you're not a U.S. person. You have a certificate of loss of nationality where someone else certifies you're not a U.S. person. And you have a proof of foreign citizenship which says you are a citizenship of somewhere else. And you have proof that doesn't prove your citizenship in any way, shape, or form. That last one, the foreign status. Nothing on there about citizenship. Nothing about anything that's useful in that regard. Okay, so keeping those four categories in mind, and I know this is hard at 8:03, on a Wednesday night, to keep those categories in mind. It's so hard that even I, when I go back to do this presentation, forget what the categories are and have to look them up again and reread the law. Am I really reading this right? Yes, I am. It's just as bad as I'm telling you, and I know you can't remember, but I'm going to help you with some little hints. Okay. So remember, we're trying to find out what are these financial institutions looking for, and what are they going to do when they find it? Okay. They're looking for your WHC, withholding certificate. They're looking for a PFC, proof of foreign citizenship. They're looking for a CLN. We'll just start with those three categories. We'll add the other one in a minute. If they know that you're a U.S. citizen or resident, somehow this is in a document or it's in the database, then you have to come up with both withholding certificate certifying you're not a U.S. person and proof that you're a citizen of another place. Those two together prove you're not a U.S. person. If they find a birthplace in the United States, let's not go over this too quickly. Birthplace in the United States, that's, what would you call that in law? I mean, you would say that's a rebuttable presumption, I think, that you're a U.S. person. If they find a U.S. birthplace, you need either a proof of claim of foreign citizenship, U.S. Canadian passport, and a certificate that you've lost your nationality in the U.S., both, or a withholding certificate on which you certify under penalties of perjury that you're not a U.S. person, and your Canadian passport. And if the latter, if you can't come up with a CLN, remember how I told you how to get it? If you can't come up with that, then you need a reasonable explanation. A reasonable explanation is that letter to the IRS, an essay, like a personal statement about why you're not a U.S. person, which your financial institution will put in their files and hang on to in case they get audited by who, you might wonder. Okay, our fourth category was this proof of claim of foreign status, and I told you that you could get it from a residence of a certification of residence from your tax authority, from your government issue ID, your driver's license, or your approved similar certificate. And I said, that's a pretty low, I mean, that doesn't say anything about your citizenship. How's that going to help? Well, you'll see where this one comes in is with the lower indicia. So we attach these really draconian, heavy indicia documentation with the ones that the U.S. really wants. See them? Citizen of the U.S., born in the U.S. We want you, says the IRS. So you got to show a lot of documents. You got to show proof that you don't belong to us. But if you just have a U.S. telephone number, don't worry. We just need the withholding certificate where you certify under penalties of perjury you're not a U.S. person, and your proof of claim of foreign status. Your Quebec driver's license will do. Or if you have a U.S. telephone number and a non-U.S., you have both. Remember that you go like you're a snowbird. You want your bank to be able to find you, and if you got both of those, we're going to need that withholding certificate from you, signing under penalty of perjury. Or look at the or your driver's license. Whew. Just a driver's license will do. By the way, the bank is not going to follow this. I just want to give you a little teaser that you're going to be asked for a withholding certificate in all circumstances. So this is all just semantics. Okay. U.S. residence or mailing address, or standing instructions to transfer to a U.S.-based account, or indications of a power of attorney over the account to a person with a U.S. address. You need both. We're going to need that penalty of perjury statement you're not a U.S. person and your driver's license. And a care of or hold mail address will take either or again, withholding certificate or. So you can see this sort of playing of a game, where we're supposed to look for things that indicate your U.S. status, but we, your bank, your family trust, your trustee, your business manager, we are not the U.S. Immigration Service. We don't know if you're a U.S. person. So we have to rely on documents that governments give you, and you're going to have to show your papers if you want a bank account in Canada. That's how it's going to be. Not because Canada wants them. Of course Canada wants to know who you are. We have Know Your Customer and anti-money laundering rules in Canada. We are not a tax haven. I think we all know that. Of course we want paperwork. Of course we have rules. We have rules, but our rules don't matter. We're engaged in a global project of finding U.S. persons, and it's the U.S. rules that tell us what to do. Are you a little puzzled by how that could be? So we have here the last piece in the puzzle. This is a subtle but powerful backstop, like a GAR, if you will, Stephen. The foreign financial institution can rely on your documents. Just collect the papers and put them in a file unless your manager knows that you're a U.S. person. Do not tell anyone you're a U.S. citizen if you were not born in the United States. If your banker knows who you are, if your business partner knows who you are, how are we going to test that? Who's going to audit that? Who's going to check that? Who's going to be called to testify to say that's a U.S. person? Daniel, you're supposed to answer those questions. Okay, so what will they do if they think you're a U.S. person? You saw they're supposed to ask for all that documentation. Sorry, I got behind in this. In my paperwork, in my paper shuffling. That's all I do now, right? Shuffle papers, and you will too. What will they do if their customers are U.S. persons? Well, we have this kind of a weird thing called an intergovernmental agreement. So this is what happened in a nutshell. When Canadian banks figured out what the U.S. was saying, do all this stuff or you're paying 30% on all U.S. cash flows? Canadian banks went to the Canadian finance minister, didn't they? You would too. And they said, hey, you guys, there's kind of a problem. We can't give the U.S. what they want because we got this privacy law in the way. We can't just give them all these documents, can we? Because people have rights in Canada. Would you mind just taking some of those rights? Would you just fix that? And of course, we have a diplomatic relationship with the United States, and we have other things that we need, and it's not just tax. And after all, it's just Americans, right? Who cares about them? So yes, of course, we're going to take this on. Canada signed an agreement with the United States to implement FATCA in Canada last year. And it was placed in the omnibus budget bill, and it was passed after about an hour and a half of discussion in the Standing Committee on Finance. The procedure for tabling treaties was not followed. This agreement, for all intents and purposes, was hidden from you because they don't want you discussing this. Now, that big they is there. It's a big, vast conspiracy, right? But, I mean, come on. If we had this conversation 2 years ago, maybe we wouldn't be so excited when an omnibus budget bill contains a treaty with the United States with a name that nobody can pronounce and nobody understands what it is. But that's, you know, we lawyers, we know. As soon as the name is really long and unwieldy, that's something we are not supposed to talk about in public. Okay. That agreement is in effect. If it wasn't in effect, what are they supposed to do if their customers are U.S. persons? They're supposed to do one of two things. Request waivers of your privacy rights, and if they get it, then report. What are they reporting? Your account number, your name, your address, your U.S. Social Security number, your Canadian taxpayer identification number, etc. All income coming into the account and the highest balance of the account in the year. Plus, plus, plus. You know, a few more bells and whistles. And if they don't get the privacy waiver for them to send that to the IRS, they close your account. Well, we have this law in Canada that says you're entitled to a bank account. So these two do not compute. So we have an IGA, an intergovernmental agreement. If you read my papers, you'll see what I think of it in more detail. Now the bank just gives the CRA all that information and they hand it to the IRS on your behalf. So they don't have to ask to waive your privacy. You don't have any. And they don't have to close your bank account. Oh, I shouldn't have put it up there. You know why it's probably. But oh, I just want to make this one point. They don't have to close your bank account. And that was the gift given to Canadian citizens resident in Canada. Hey, we've protected your bank accounts because if we didn't do it, your banks would close them to avoid the 30% penalty. So you got privacy or banking rights, but you can't have both in Canada, only one. And the one you get is the right to have your bank account. Why is all this troubling? Do I need to ask that? Taxpayer confidentiality is established globally for a very good reason. People have rights to privacy and confidentiality of their personal financial data. And yes, of course, the government has a reason to need to know that when they're trying to tax you because that's where you live and they're your government, right? The U.S. has a law on the books that said it is a federal crime to disclose confidential taxpayer information to anyone unless expressly authorized. We had the same law. FATCA just ignores that for us. U.S. law still in place, Canada eviscerated. The U.S. FATCA regime overrides all tax treaties. That is, Canada already had a deal with the U.S. on how we were going to share taxes and how we were going to share information. The U.S. has ridden right over that agreement, just acting as if it never existed and it doesn't matter. The FATCA imposes new taxes in contravention of the treaty terms. I can't believe no one's litigating yet, but I hope they will. And there's a lack of comedy, which I think is quite important. Don't you flash that 5-minute napkin at me. I've got a long ways to go. There's a lack of comedy. When the U.S. imposes its will through economic sanctions, what you should expect is that the U.S. will be the last remaining tax haven. That's where we are right now. Every country in the world will comply with FATCA, and the U.S. has no incentive to comply with your law. Why should they? You're already on board with what they need. So that's a problem, I think, in international relations. And we talk about democracy and the problem of dealing with our fellow countries as independent states. But that problem of reciprocity actually extends. It's probably unlikely, even if it's desirable. I just have to touch on this for a moment. Just think about the cyber criminals salivating at the prospects of all that information being delivered on a global basis. I think we should at least be thinking. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but I'm saying, should we do it with a gun at our head and with no control whatsoever over the manner or character that in which data is going to be shared, and without ever having a conversation about whose data is going to be shared? Just going along with the U.S. Yeah, your citizens are yours to do with what you want, and we, Canada, are obligated to help you do that. We're going to do it for you. So this brings me to birthright citizenship. So Daniel, you started talking about birthright as a starting point, and about thinking about when you haven't done anything but your genes or your family line, your lineage, places you in a position which is advantageous or disadvantageous. And that justice, a just society, you said, is one that tries to neutralize the impact of luck. Well, I've been hinting at the bad luck of being a U.S. citizen, but this is actually pretty troubling. The U.S. is the only country in the world that claims its tax jurisdiction on the basis of legal status rather than residence. Every other country, including Canada, taxes all people who reside in Canada, whether they're citizens or not citizens, on a worldwide basis. The U.S. is the only country that's not content to tax everyone in the United States, but also wants its global diaspora, no matter how they got that status. The U.S. confers it. It confers it automatically. You cannot deny it. You cannot get rid of it. You cannot give it up without paying. That's the U.S. system. It's only the U.S. system. If you want to leave Canada, all you have to do is go watch the news last year and watch Ted Cruz realize he's a Canadian citizen. Do you know who he is? The senator in the U.S. who wants to be president? Exactly. He cannot. You're right. But he thinks he can. But he won't. He's a U.S. person, for sure. Born in Canada to a U.S. parent. He's a U.S. person, but born in Canada, he's also a Canadian person by birthright citizenship. But when he found it inconvenient to be Canadian, he declared his intention to give up Canadian citizenship. There was no fee, there was no 5 years of tax compliance, there was no visit with the embassy, there was no prove your life. There was just leave. Goodbye, you've never lived here except when you were a child. Why would we claim you? That is not how the U.S. sees the world. We should be surprised by that. I think we want to know why. That's okay. We have never had a conversation, not once, in this 4 years since FATCA was imposed as a law in the United States. No one has ever had a conversation about why it's okay for the U.S. to do this. I think philosophy should answer that question. I think it will answer that question in the, it's not. There's a birthright lottery problem. There's an inner, this is possibly, and I mean, I know you're not going to believe this, but I actually think this is true. I think the people that wrote FATCA really did have the American with the USB Swiss bank account in their minds. I think they wrote that law to catch that bad guy. But the collateral damage could be 1 million Canadians who are now the feature story. U.S. persons living in Canada, born in the United States, born to a U.S. parent, never lived in America, no U.S. income, no U.S. sources of income, no offshore bank accounts, no tax evasion. But in the eyes of the U.S., you're a tax debtor, you will be caught, you will be found, and you will be brought to justice, and your banks will do it, and the CRA will help them. Sorry, I get a little fired up at this part of the presentation. And I hear some grumbling, which could be pushing back. I'll take all comers, I promise, in a few minutes. Am I still okay?
Yes.
All right, good. You want to hear some more? I think when you combine FACA with this birthright citizenship, you get dramatic and unjustified effects. Lifelong Canadians are deemed U.S. persons retroactively and without warning. They're subject to enormous fines. They're afraid. They're scared. What happens when the IRS finds? Surely the IRS won't come after me. I'm a widower living on a pension. Sorry, your pension is in what the U.S. calls a passive foreign investment company. You were supposed to be declaring that your whole life. You now owe us five times what its full amount was. But you can come in, we'll have a program for you to kind of minimize the penalty and clear you right up. Exit from U.S. person status requires expensive tax compliance plus a flat fee to leave, $2,350, which I rounded up to $2,400. Tell me I shouldn't have. U.S. lawmakers are now threatening permanent exile. If you exit the U.S. now, and we think it's for tax purposes, you can never step foot on our shore again. They're doing this to us, their neighbors. People were born in the U.S. because that was the closest hospital, are being threatened with never being allowed to go to the U.S. again if they don't shut up, comply, and obey, and pay up for not having done it your whole life. And here's the rub. The basic tax service for filling out your return in the United States is both expensive and totally the Wild West. Anybody, and this could be good news, we'll talk about that later, anybody could fill out a tax return. You're not regulated by the IRS. You can help someone fill out a tax return. So let's just think about this. Let's just step back. Middle and working class people could very well be the actual target of FATCA. Not tax evaders, not offshore dodgers, not people hiding away, not people with yachts. No, people with jobs and pension funds and lifetime savings who just did not think that a foreign government, a government they considered foreign to them, could have any justiciable claim against them. And now they've woken up to learn not only has that government made a claim, but their own government has accepted it and will implement it on behalf of what they consider to be a foreign government. I find that fairly objectionable. Canada, we are told, and I have been personally told, is not a tax haven. We are told that we have a long-term exchange information relationship between Canada and the United States. For sure, that's true. We had a treaty in which we agreed to share information with the United States 20 years ago. Canada, we are told, is not the target. I had myself personally was told by a former U.S. government official, Canada should just, shh, you're not the target. Comply, obey, you can't push back. We're not after you. But information is not the end, is it? It's the beginning. Evidence is going to mount of non-compliant birthright citizens. We might have a million. We might have more. If birthright citizenship, non-compliance, is tax evasion, then Canada is a haven of epic proportions. It's huge. It's the biggest one there is. There isn't a bigger tax haven than Canada if birthright citizenship equals tax evasion. Relative to the rest of the world, we're in it pretty deep. And I don't know if we should, when the law on the books looks really dire, it is really serious. It is people's pensions. It is people who have owned their homes for 30 years afraid of the IRS. They're Canadian citizens that live in Canada. The U.S., I think, is entrenched in a position. A position has been taken. We were told on the floor of a Finance Committee meeting that the U.S. has spoken. In fact, I think that was spoken on the floor of Parliament. To explain why FACA is the law in Canada, the U.S. has spoken. So the U.S., and this is hard, right? If you take a position, it's really hard to then say, oh, you know, let's just, never mind. Or we'll just not kind of be so. You have to sort of do that in the law as it's implemented. But my problem with that as a lawyer, it's really hard for me to read a law on the books and not think that there's any possibility that it will be implemented as written. I have the tendency to think it will be implemented as written, and if it is implemented as written, we've got a problem. And the U.S. is going to have a problem if they don't enforce their own law. How do you then explain? Look at all the information you have on all the tax evaders in Canada. Why aren't you going after those tax cheats? I had an American at a conference say to me, why don't you, those Canadians want to fill out their IRS forms? I was stunned. I didn't even know how to answer. That doesn't happen very often to me. You can believe it. I think that the U.S. will be forced to press this issue in the face of incontrovertible evidence, which is furnished by the CRA data. We are a fully developed, very sophisticated financial have a very sophisticated financial infrastructure in this country. Of all the countries in the world that are going to be able to do what FATCA says, who's going to be able to do it? We are! We're capable. That's not the case for a lot of other countries. I mean, if you think it's bad for Canada, think about a country that is strapped for resources, that now has to spend all of its resources finding U.S. persons and turning them over to the IRS instead of thinking about how to administer their own tax system. At least we don't have that problem. Our government has told us, no problem, the costs of FACA are nil, we're just covering it in our regular budget. What happens next? I'm coming around to the end here. I know you're ready for it. The IGA, the agreement to share information, has been implemented pursuant to the tax treaty between the U.S. and Canada, which explains how we share information between the CRA and the IRS. There is a long history, though, of limited assistance in the collection of tax debts, sparked, I might add, by the United States, who does not want to help other countries collect taxes in America. So they have something that they've called the revenue rule in the treaty. Now, this is the most technical argument I have yet, and almost nobody gets here with me, and once I get done, you'll be puzzling, scratching your head, and still not really sure what I'm saying, but here it is in a nutshell. The revenue rule says, and this is enshrined in the tax treaty, that Canada will not collect U.S. tax debts on Canadian citizens. Doesn't say anything about residents, just citizens. So under Article 27, which is where we share the information, thousands of tax evaders are going to be exposed. Hard to avoid that. But under Article 26A, no asset or income seizures are possible, theoretically, for now, until. Well, you would feel frustrated, right? You put this huge global infrastructure in to get all this information, and you know exactly where the evaders are, and exactly how much the money they have, and exactly who's got it, and you can't touch it? Expect U.S. lawmakers to start looking askance at Canada, knowingly harboring tax cheats. And expect lawsuits, I would think, and I hope, to restore the rights of individuals that have been lost in this agreement. Expect more than that, but you'll have to read some of my papers to get it. Restoring rights through litigation, it's already starting. In Canada, we have a grassroots group, a real one, a real grassroots group. People putting $10 at a time into a fund to pay for a charter challenge on the grounds that the agreement to share information is a federal encroachment of provincial power to regulate banks, on the grounds that we have a series of violations of charter rights, including the right to privacy, et cetera, the right to security of life, liberty, and person, and all on and on, that there's a violation of the actual income tax law, which requires you to have a tax treaty before you start sharing information with other countries, and a violation of the existing treaty, which does not contemplate the one-sided furnishing of information, nor does it contemplate Canada perfecting U.S. citizenship taxation. And in the United States, that same grassroots group is litigating the fee to renounce, just the fee, on the grounds that that's a violation of the internationally recognized right to leave, and that it's an executive encroachment of legislative power, and that it's a violation of administrative procedure. So you see some technical litigation going on. And there's more litigation expected in Canada and the U.S., and I would think elsewhere. I mean, how could there not be? This regime is enormous. I mean, it just in terms of the sheer volume of issues, we should be in business for years. Which brings me to my very sad and final point, which is that the news isn't all bleak. My goodness, if you're okay with using rent-seeking to exploit on the miseries of others, we've got a cash cow on our hands. E-filing is woefully inadequate for foreign U.S. persons. That means every person that's filing a tax return outside of the U.S. needs a tax return preparer. And tax return preparers are not regulated by the IRS. If you'd like to know why, see Allison Christians. While regulating tax preparers is a global problem for the IRS. I'll be happy to send you the link. That means, that's a very simple calculation, new, broad, lucrative practice area, no experience necessary. We should put out a flyer. Anecdotal evidence, this is from people I know. $500 to $1,000 for a single year's U.S. tax return. Just multiply that by the number of years it's going to take for all your clients to get rid of their U.S. citizenship. This is going to last for a while. Another $500 for a related document that I have not talked about, which is even more egregious. It's called the Foreign Bank Account Report. Even people who know they're supposed to file the U.S. taxes don't usually know about the FBAR. Believe me, it's a doozy. If you'd like to know more, read Allison Christian's Why the Foreign FBAR, the FBAR Needs to be Fixed, and now I'll be happy to send you a link. $25,000 to $50,000 I have been quoted as a standard fee. That's your accountant's fee. To get you into compliance for someone with a complicated life. That means somebody with a mutual fund and savings or a small business. God help you if you have a small business outside of the U.S. Really, I can't, so God help you. And then, if you're not into tax return preparation, how about litigation fees? And you're going to get some cross-border experience in litigation because your clients are going to be contesting the renunciation fee. Perhaps even citizenship taxation by the U.S. will finally become something we start talking about when people realize how unfair it is, how utterly unjust. And that's just putting aside the loss of privacy rights and other protections in Canada that have been swept aside in service of this agreement, as if all you have to do is route through the CRA and none of your charter rights matter anymore. That can't be right either. I expect to see some difficulty with that. Well, I'm sorry to end on that note. I realize that what I pretended was not so bleak is actually really bleak. Really bleak. If what we care about is serving clients with some pride and honor and being able to sleep at night. But I thank you for your time. I know it was a long lecture and there's a lot of technical stuff in there. And if you want any of the supporting documentation, I would be more than happy to share with you the growing body of literature which I am producing on this subject right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that remarkable talk, which, of course, raises very important questions. anybody who, most people who, most accounts which receive U.S. dividends or income have had to have the account holder file a W-8-BEN, which is, as Allison says, is a very short document. But now, for corporate accounts and some other entities, there's a W-8-BENE, which you can find online with the instruction sheet, and I've actually sat down and tried to start filling it out, and I tell you, you have some unexpected pleasures ahead of you. If you do so, my financial institution insists that because my corporate account was open with a Canadian government-issued identification of citizenship, I do not have to file for the corporation W-8-BNE, but I am not sure of that yet, so I'm going to pursue that question. Sorry?
Pay an accountant. You're going to pay an accountant.
Well, I don't know. I may get it free from you, because you have to, you have to deal with that in class, because it's very important. Now, I can't claim to be a haven maven, but I will say that some of these issues raised recollections. The 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution follows the common law, as we do in Canada, that birth in the country gives rise to citizenship, and in fact it entrenches that, although there's a lot of talk about, in the U.S., getting rid of the constitutionally entrenched rule because it gives rise to a tourism, to citizenship tourism. People come into the U.S. to have their children born there in order to have the children become U.S. citizens. The U.S. used to have easy expatriation, and we had students here who, Americans, who wanted to become members of the Quebec Bar. Canadian nationality was required in those years, and they would get Canadian citizenship. The U.S. authorities would say that that was a voluntary expatriation, and various contestations were made that it was involuntary because they had to earn a living and couldn't without the Canadian citizenship. And we had actually an American who took some interesting litigation to avoid having to file under the then regulations. He got them declared invalid under the Canadian Citizenship Act, regulations requiring him to file an express renunciation of foreign citizenship to get Canadian citizenship. Ulan and the Queen in the federal court of Canada. On the Ted Cruz thing, that's kind of interesting because when I last looked at it, my understanding was that Cruz was not being allowed to file a renunciation of Canadian citizenship because the Canadian authorities required proof of American citizenship, and that could not be provided because it was not clear that at the time of his birth in Canada, his father, who was originally Mexican, was already an American citizen. So Cruz may have problems establishing his American citizenship, which of course is required under the U.S. Constitution to run for president. Anyway, so we can follow that. Ted Cruz, natural born, could that be by descent? For example, is natural born include by descent? I think probably when it gets to the courts, that will be the case. But he does have to be an American citizen. And whether he is or not, I think is still in question and not able to be proved to the satisfaction of the Canadian authorities anyway. But on the FATCA, that really is a nightmare, and you can see it immediately if you, you need to establish in one form or other the W-8-BEN, because otherwise you can't get the treaty rates. You're not going to get 15% withholding on U.S. dividends. And so you do have to file a form or be exempted on some basis. Anyway, I'll turn it over to to Daniel and Allison to... well, this is the few minutes of panel, so you get a chance for a brief... some thoughts.
Am I a U.S. person because I was a TA in the States?
If you had a green card, did you have a green card?
No green card.
You're lucky.
Okay, good.
Did you notice I said probably?
I did notice that.
Yeah, I'm not an immigration attorney.
Right. I'd be inclined to...
Yeah.
So, any thoughts, questions, comments?
I'd like to know if there is any provision in FATCA for people who have lost, or for an American person whose citizenship has been revoked by the U.S. government. And I'm thinking about Edward Snowden. Let's say, for example, if he comes to Canada, he gets asylum in Canada, and he opens a bank account. Will that apply to him?
His citizenship hasn't been revoked. His passport was revoked. He's just he just can't move.
But his passport was revoked by the U.S. government.
Right.
Okay, so will FATCA apply to him?
Oh, yeah.
If he comes to Canada...
Listen, Glenn Greenwald is subject to FATCA. He may not know it. Okay. I've been trying to get him to realize it, right? Because he lives in Brazil, but he's a U.S. citizen. So FATCA, it applies to all U.S. citizens all over the world. Yes, Edward Snowden. Yes, Glenn Greenwald. Yes, all the agitators you can possibly find. Sure, of course. I mean, don't you think the U.S. wants to know about them and their accounts? I think they'd be especially interested in those guys.
Like, I don't know, France or Germany? Or
so the first country to agree to FATCA was France, and the UK was right behind. The UK has not only not objected, but they've instituted FATCA 2.0 with the UK, but only applied to, for some reason, to UK's tax, the Channel Islands, and only in a smaller circle. And it's a separate regime which I haven't studied at length, so I can't tell you. What I can tell you is this. From the perspective of all other countries, the depth of U.S. citizenship taxation is not well understood. And my evidence of that is anecdotal. It lies in an access to information request that I made with respect to the adoption of FATCA in Canada, in which I can see that letters have gone back and forth interagency, in which it was requested that a study be made to explain citizenship taxation. So this law was already in progress. This law has been, U.S. citizenship taxation has been on the books for ever since the U.S. has had income taxation. It was designed as a punishment for those who would flee in civil war. So those in Canada who got here as a result of that first round of leaving the United States, some of them are particularly aggrieved by being pulled back in. But the short answer is that no country on an official level has spoken out against FATCA. And the reason is because we are not adopting FATCA in the context of citizenship taxation. We're adopting it in the context of tax evasion. And no one can be seen to be against a regime which stops tax evaders. No politician can afford that. So the answer on the global stage is, we've got to do this.
On the practical term, was there a case? Because it was recently adopted.
Excuse me, I'll just make an announcement. We are live streaming this presentation to other rooms, so people in the other room can't hear your questions if you're not using the microphone. So I would ask everybody to use the microphone for the questions. Thank you.
I have a personal situation which I won't bore you with. However, from the benefit of my limited experience, I'll tell you about a few catch-22s that are happening in this situation. Many years ago, if you took the oath to become a Canadian, you presumably lost your citizenship. Years later, the Americans changed the law, and you didn't lose your citizenship. Today, nobody knows
right.
If you became a Canadian under the earlier, are you or are you not an American person right. if you were born in the U.S.? Catch 22-1. Secondly, almost every accounting firm I'm talking to is saying, we don't know what an American person is, but you better go through this streamlined process.
Right.
For which I have had quotes running from $1,200 to $12,000.
That's just for the accounting services. That's not for
that's
the actual.
That's to do the filing under the streamlined process.
Not the tax, right?
No, nothing right. to do with tax. The streamlined process is you file 3 years of personal tax returns. But if you have any corporations for which you have signing authority, you don't even have to own it, for which you have signing authority, you have to give them 6 years under your of all the bank accounts and the maximum balances over the six-year period. Now comes another catch-22. You're a Canadian. You never filed in the U.S. To file the tax returns, you need a social security number in the U.S.
Right.
Another catch-22. Yeah. Now, the accountants, and they may be wrong, are telling you, this is the accountants, not necessarily tax lawyers, nor immigration lawyers, they're telling you that if you want to renounce, you have to first go through the streamlined process and then renounce.
Right.
And then they're cautioning you that if at that stage you renounce, the U.S. will deem that you disposed of all your assets and tax you on the disposal of all your assets.
Correct.
Come on.
Come on.
I have written a letter to the commissioner of the CRA, the minister mm-hmm. of revenue, and the minister of citizenship and immigration. Mm-hmm. I wrote the letter a month ago. And I have no responses.
No, you won't get a response. The response will be, this is U.S. law, not our law, your problem. That I've seen that response. That response has been spoken more than once.
Well, you increase my frustration.
Yeah. Listen, I have a vested interest in you being frustrated because what I have so far is a lot of silence and a lot of acquiescence to what is effectively a very unjust regime. And so, for this to change, Daniel, we talked about this a little bit before, that you can't expect the people who write the rules to understand the injustice just from the rule they wrote. You have to see how it works out in practice, right? And so people react, and maybe they react with blinders on, like this sort of everyday libertarianism, but sometimes the sort of the shout of the frustrated is the way.
Well, there's another major problem. Yeah. I'm being told.
By the way, you do not have to go through streamlined compliance to shed your U.S. citizenship. That is incorrect. Just a point of fact.
I'm coming to see you.
I just want to add that I don't take clients. I have no clients. I have no vested interest. I will not take any money in this regime, okay. Not a penny.
Good.
And I'm the only one.
Now I'm really coming to see you. But the other thing that I'm being told is that shortly it is very possible that when you cross the border with your Canadian passport, if it says you were born in the U.S.,
right.
you will be told at the border you cannot come in if you don't have
correct.
An American passport.
Right.
So another catch 22.
That's correct. You've been told a lot of correct things.
Pardon me?
You've been told a lot of correct things.
Okay, the last one. There's a rumor, only a rumor, that if you do go through the process and you do renounce, that afterwards it's possible that Homeland Security will put you on a non-access list.
Right. Would you have it any other way? We're losing our room.
Okay, I see there are a couple of questions at the back. Two ladies there. Yes. Le micro, s'il vous plaît, the microphone, please.
What time do we go to?
You have another 5 minutes.
I'm losing the room, Daniel. I'm not
there are just talk. Some people that.
I was struck on the power of attorney point. Practically speaking, would this mean an elderly parent living in Canada who gives a power of attorney to his children who live in the States?
Right.
I mean, a power of attorney, as you well know, it's not my money, it's the money of the person
right.
I'm managing. But would the money of the elderly person who's never been born in the U.S., never lived in the U.S., would that be subject to FATCA?
So it's the first step is just that account will be flagged.
Yeah.
The power of attorney will flag the account as a possible U.S. account, and the person will be asked to furnish information.
So they will have to go through all the loops just even on a power of attorney.
Yeah.
That's
I mean, the first step, right?
That's
it doesn't
right.
mean that a tax,
yeah.
I mean, don't forget, it doesn't always mean that a tax applies. Usually it's not a tax, it's usually a penalty anyway.
No.
You know, you pay a lot of tax in Canada, so you don't actually owe the IRS any tax.
Yeah.
So you just have to pay the penalties for not filling out the forms you were supposed to fill out. But this person, this hypothetical elderly person, may not be a U.S. person.
No, they're not.
But you will be asked to sign under penalties of perjury that you are not.
So by
right.
having a power of
yes.
attorney
yes.
to a U.S.
It's
resident,
flagged.
You're automatically the Canadian account has to prove to FATCA
yeah.
that it's not subject to FATCA.
Exactly. And I mean, I think that's the gentleman's point that, you know, how can the accountants don't know what a U.S. person is. So to be on the safe side, just, you know, get your... Just say you're a U.S. person and fill out this form
no, but
so we can do
it. It's different if you happen to have been born in the U.S. or if you spent
right.
some time, but if you have no affiliation whatsoever, you're
right.
just giving a power of attorney to someone. Okay,
yep.
thank you.
But if she accepts that she is a U.S. person because of the power of attorney...
No. She's not a U.S. person because of the power of attorney. No.
The account
no.
is not.
The question,
but the
she will be asked to fill out this form to tell us that you are not and give
have
us the
to
other...
Prove,
yeah.
You'll have to prove to the financial institution
right.
that the account over which the U.S. resident has a power of attorney is not one that belongs to a U.S. resident.
Correct.
But the fact is you have to go through that proof.
For sure.
Okay.
There was another question in the back.
Thank you.
What are enforcement mechanisms? Like,
well,
can they freeze your account?
That's a very good question. So, unstated in FATCA and not discussed in polite circles is what will happen if. So, now, just this is a geopolitical problem. We don't have time for this. But here's the geopolitical problem. Now that you have a treaty in place, it's the CRA that enforces FATCA, not the IRS. It's the CRA that has to audit or check or come after you. And what will they do? So just to kind of pinch your, you know, if you haven't really got outraged yet, this will get you. If you're a U.S. person, part of the law that was enacted to get this FATCA working in Canada says if you're not a U.S. person, you're supposed to use your U.S. Social Security number, as you pointed out. And if the bank asks you for your Social Security number and you don't give it, you have to pay $100. It's just a fine. It's just a fine for not giving your Social Security that we just voluntarily stuck in the law. Why would we do that? The U.S. did not tell Canada, stick a fine in there to just turn the knife. No one told Canada to do that, but they did. So you can take from that what you will. Canada has written a law which implements the act for Canadian law purposes, which means the full force of the CRA is behind this law.
Yeah, my question is more, let's say someone is assessed and they have to pay, I don't know, $50,000. How will the U.S. get the money? Are they going
to? I'm not allowed to answer it, but because I see this going on, like we're done. So here's the answer. So far, they can't under the tax treaty if you're a Canadian citizen. But if you're a Canadian resident who's not yet a Canadian citizen and you are a U.S. citizen, they can take your assets. Yes.
Okay, I see our time has expired, so it only remains to thank our two colleagues.
I'm sorry.